Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the final event in the 16th season of the Leon Panetta Lecture Series. It's hard to believe that we've gone through these past few months so quickly. Leon got out here in late February, and he jumped into planning and getting things set up, and here we are now in June, and we're at the end of the season. And this season, our theme, as you know, has been gridlock or action. We've looked at a series of issues that have been long-term challenges, but where recent events have made action more essential than ever. Tonight's focus on the Middle East has the broadest historical scope of any of the issues we talked about this spring, and it is also one of the most pressing. During his time as director of the CIA and later as Secretary of Defense, our moderator and the founder of this lecture series spent a lot of time in this region, in the Middle East. And he will tell you there is no denying that the security of our nation is inherently linked to the stability of the Middle East. The fallout of the Arab Spring, the chaos in Syria, the threats from Iran, and the struggle for peace between Israel and the Palestinians continue to challenge United States foreign and defense policy. When we look back on the aftermath of the revolutions in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya, and the ongoing unrest in Syria and Palestine, I am reminded of a quote from George Bernard Shaw, who said, "Revolutions have never lightened the burden of tyranny. They have only shifted it to another's shoulders." This is a challenge facing young people across the Middle East as they come of age in the midst of conflict and war. Who will help them bear the burden of their quest for liberty and for peace as the legacy of the past now settles on their shoulders? There's no easy solution. The players are complex, with sectarian, tribal, and cultural divides that go back for centuries. And our own nation is at a crossroads, as you know. Weary from more than a decade of war in Afghanistan and Iraq and facing serious fiscal restrictions, the United States must still play an essential role in this region. The fate of these nations is directly tied to our own security, our energy policy, and our hope for the spread of democracy and the preservation of human rights. Tonight, we'll discuss how we balance these diverse objectives in one of the most volatile regions on the globe. Our first keynote speaker, our first guest, is a former six-term senator and is considered one of the nation's leading experts on foreign policy. A former Rhodes Scholar, he began his political career as mayor of Indianapolis. Elected to the Senate in 1976, he is respected globally as an international statesman and leader on nuclear disarmament. When he left office, he was the ranking Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, having twice served as that committee's chairman. He's an unwavering advocate of United States leadership in the world, with emphasis on national security, free trade, and economic growth, and is an international leader on nuclear disarmament. Leon worked closely with him when he was at the CIA and at the Pentagon. Please welcome Senator Richard Lugar. Our second guest began his service to his country at the age of 17 when he enlisted in the Israeli army. He went on to lead Israel's elite anti-terrorist unit for many years and then served as head of the nation's intelligence and central command. In 1991, he was appointed Army Chief of Staff and became the nation's top military leader. After 5 years as Chief of Staff, he left that post to become Interior Minister in the government headed by Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. In the wake of Rabin's assassination, he assumed the role of Foreign Minister and soon after assumed leadership of Israel's Labor Party. became prime minister in 1999. While in office, he ended Israel's 17-year occupation of southern Lebanon and offered unprecedented concessions to the Palestinians. In June 2007, he was once again elected to lead the Labor Party and was immediately appointed to serve as Minister of Defense. In that capacity, he and Leon built a strong partnership for peace. Throughout his time in leadership, he has advocated for a negotiated settlement with the Palestinians while supporting the Israeli government's hard line on security issues. Please welcome Minister Ehud Barak. Our third guest was one of Congress' most influential voices on security issues. First elected to the Senate in 1988, he went on to serve four terms, the last term as an independent. He was also a vice presidential candidate on the Democratic ticket in 2000. While in the Senate, he fought to protect the nation from terrorist attacks and served as chairman of the Committee on Homeland Security. He has been at the forefront of efforts not only to increase our investment in defense, but to transform our armed forces to better meet the threats of the 21st century. He and Leon work closely together on intelligence and military issues to make certain that America remains the strongest military power in the world. He repeatedly worked across party lines in order to pursue compromise on important foreign policy issues, including harsher sanctions on Iran, as well as sanctions targeting Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad for carrying out violent crackdowns against protesters in his country. Please welcome Senator Joseph Lieberman.
How are you?
And finally, leading our discussion is a man who spent the last 4 years working to bring about solutions to the war on terror and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. He knows firsthand the costly price our nation pays in our efforts to preserve stability in this region. Please welcome our moderator, Secretary Leon Panetta.
Thank you very much. Thank you, and welcome to everybody. This is our fourth lecture, finishing up our series this year. And as you know, the theme of our lecture was gridlock versus action. We've covered a lot of interesting topics. We began with a discussion on immigration reform, talked about the budget, and then recently had a discussion about gun control. The Middle East is a great example of gridlock, of turmoil, and concern about what kind of action should take place. This tonight, we have a very special lecture. We've got three wonderful guests, but we also have a very important topic, which is the Middle East, and what steps do we take to deal with the challenges that are there. It's a big subject. What I'm going to try to do is cover several key areas, one being the Arab Spring and what's happened with the countries in the Middle East. Secondly, I'd like to discuss the peace negotiations, hopefully the peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians, talk about Iran, talk about Syria, and hopefully, if we have time, talk about the issue of in this country, balancing our security and our freedoms and how we do that best. So let me begin this evening. First of all, welcome. It's nice to have all of you with us. looking at the Arab Spring, since I think December, I guess it was December of 2010, we had a revolution in Tunisia, we had a revolution in Libya, we had a revolution in Egypt. Obviously, all of that produced a change in their governments. Syria is now going through a civil war, major civil war, that will determine what ultimately happens there. We've had disturbances in Bahrain, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Turkey is now going through demonstrations as well. Some have described the changes that have taken place as probably the greatest change that's taken place in a region since the end of the Ottoman Empire. I know that there are obviously particular reasons involved in each of these countries, but what I'd like to do is to have each of you stand back and give us a sense of what you believe are the causes that led to this so-called Arab Spring. Dick?
Well, I believe that essentially there were young people in each of these countries. They were most conspicuous originally in Tunisia, certainly in Tahrir Square in Egypt, who are talented, who did not see much hope in front of them. Very, very high unemployment in all the countries, especially high among young people, and with the now a majority of the people being young, 25 or under, so forth. So as a result, given the gentleman who immolated himself, a teenager in Tunisia, this heightened the imagination, it seems to me, throughout at least the first three countries, Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt, and as a result, people began to come out in the streets. And it was a time likewise, and this has not been commented on so much, back in the hustings, this is especially the case in Egypt with 60 to 80 million people, depending upon how you count everybody, they weren't having very much to eat. One of the things that Mubarak had been able to do in the past was to get subsidies out or food. And that was true of Gaddafi, it was true of Ben Ali in Tunisia. That's not commented on as much, but it was not just the young people. It was a sense of desperation of people that are on the edge of starvation. And given economic downturns in most of these countries, that hasn't been noted as much as the European situation up above, why there wasn't going to be any subsidy. These were situations in which there was no particular cure to the normal way of buying off the revolt. So given the impetus of the young people, and then out, as I say, in the hustings, there being a desire, this has just got to change, things were ripe. And furthermore, in the case of at least each of these countries and their different military situations, the military took a point of view that was not necessarily helpful to the leadership. Now, later on, we'll get back to how the military has sort of come around, and in many cases, the people are dependent on the military again, wanting a second chance. First time didn't work with democracy as they found it, but fundamentally, the food situation hadn't changed, nor has the water supply in most of these countries. And we'll get into Syria in due course, but a huge problem there, in which there's not going to be much agriculture in parts of the country. And this foments huge unrest, leaving aside your politics, just on how you're going to survive. So the simultaneity of youth unemployment, a large population being that way, with the elderly not getting the subsidies as they usually got, and the buy-off really from the authoritarian governments, things were ripe, and one country heard about the other and decided it's our turn.
Ehud?
I think there is not a lot to add to what Dick described. I would just point to the very fact that there is a deep, deep frustration all around the Arab world and Muslim world from what the contradiction between Islam and Moderna. There is no real ripeness in our neighborhood for democracy. Even when things collapse, think of Czechoslovakia, those of you who watch the European history, when the whole thing collapsed, there was a Václav Havel kind of intellectual, moral beacon that attracted the whole society to support democracy. Here, as the Russians warned us, when to just enter Libya. Do you really believe you know who are all these extremists in the tribes in Kyrenaica that are waiting to the falling down of Gaddafi and later on with Egypt? When it ended up that probably the youngsters and the kind of highly digitized people initiated, but immediately the ones who took power was the most organized, well-organized force, namely the Muslim Brotherhood, not necessarily for the better for the Egyptian people. So we started with something that we called Arab Spring. We are not through an Islamic winter, but we have still to wait to see what will come out of it.
Joe?
So I should say, hopefully, that the Islamic winter will lead before long to a democratic spring. As Americans, I think we're compelled by our own national values, national purpose, our history, Declaration of Independence, to take these uprisings in the Arab world as a positive development, even if they have ushered in now in some of the countries, like Egypt, a period that is uncertain and even threatening to us. I agree with both what Dick and Ehud said. I went over to Egypt and Tunisia with John McCain after. I have trouble making trips without him. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Lindsey
Graham came. He wasn't on this trip, but I don't know where he was. But what struck me was that what we were dealing with here, as we did in Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and a lot of other places that broke through to freedom in my lifetime, was very, very shared human yearnings, which is to be free, to make more money, and to have your children do better than you do. And in all these countries, they were living, Egypt and Tunisia, they were living under a autocratic government, so that they not only didn't have freedoms, but more to the point, as Dick said, the children of the so-called middle class, well-educated, no opportunities. And the autocrats leading the country, you remember Lord Acton, since we're in an academic setting, I want to cite somebody. Lord Acton said, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. So one of the things that happened, I cite Egypt and Tunisia, and I heard this a lot when we were there within a month after the uprisings, was that it was not only about freedom, it was an anger that the Mubarak and Ben Ali and the cadres around them, and in Ben Ali's case, his family, and to some extent with Mubarak's family, they were basically taking the nation's wealth, and everybody else was left behind. So these were revolutions that I think were led by a relatively educated, middle-class young people. But I end with the problem. As the elections occurred, certainly in Egypt, that group that led the masses in Tahrir Square and brought down Mubarak didn't win the elections. The Muslim Brotherhood did. And that maybe is another question.
May I add a remark? In a short and medium term, it will be very tough. It might get worse before it turns better because of the reasons that I've already mentioned. But we used to say in the Middle East that a pessimist in the Middle East is an optimist with experience. And somehow, but when you think about it thoroughly in historic terms, let's think decades down the stream, it's extremely moving and inspiring development. Namely, the people, for the first time, stood on their feet and decide what they want, and it leaves an impact. Think of those of you who are acquainted with the history of Europe of 1848, the Spring of Nations, where we took the association of Spring, Arab Spring. Spring of Nations 1848 was suppressed by the absolute dictators of the time, or kings. And it succeeded nowhere. But Europe never remained the same place. It took several decades, and Europe turned over, no absolute monarch anymore in several decades. It took, of course, the tragedies of the 20th century, including two world wars, to bring Europe to what it's now. And so we need, and the Arabs are reminding us, the intellectuals of the Arabs, remember your pace. It took you hundreds of years to change Europe into what it's now. It took America a long way, and right. Still some things probably have to be corrected. But so always. Give us the credit for patience.
I don't mean to try to one-up with something that Ehud said, but I want to take something that Ben-Gurion said in Israel and say that I hope it spreads throughout the Middle East, which is Ben-Gurion said that in Israel, if you don't believe in miracles, you're not a realist. And that we have to kind of spread that attitude throughout the Arab world.
Dick, let me ask you something. In the name of security and stability in that part of the world, both the United States, Israel, our allies, we dealt with Mubarak. We dealt with the kings of Saudi Arabia and Jordan and elsewhere. We dealt with monarchs there. Even though we knew that they didn't represent the best democratic values, we still dealt with them. Did those policies contribute at all to what happened?
I don't believe so. I think essentially we dealt with the people that were there because we were not in the habit of overturning governments just for the sake of it. And furthermore, with even all the difficulties these rulers had in at least evidencing thoughts about human rights, women's rights, children's rights, and so forth, they offer stability. And stability has been important for our defense ever since we had 9/11. In other words, to try to get into Afghanistan to begin with, to clean up the Al-Qaeda, quite apart from things that followed that, if we had Arab Spring going on all around the Mediterranean at the time, this would have made life even more difficult in terms of our own defense and our own situation. Likewise, and who would be better able to testify to this, but for a long while, the agreements between Israel and Egypt worked. The Congress voted regularly aid to both, as we had promised to do in the past. I remember Mubarak's visits to the Foreign Relations Committee. He brought along his sons, and there was a feeling there was going to be continuity in that situation, fathers and sons. The sons look even brighter than, I remember Senator Arlen Specter used to talk about, love to play some games with Mubarak, and it was that kind of camaraderie. That won't happen again, and we're in a situation in the Mediterranean now in which we're claiming correctly, listen up, we're the only fleet that can keep foreign trade or our trade or any trade going there as well as in the Pacific, and therefore you ought to respect all of that. And at the same time, thank goodness, we're obtaining much greater energy independence, so we don't have the same liabilities that we used to have when we made do with the Saudi monarchs back in the 1930s. And Franklin Roosevelt sort of implicitly said, we need your oil and we'll protect you. And we spent a lot of money and took a lot of risks over several decades through several what might have been Arab Springs, but we wanted stability because we needed it for our own economy.
Hey, Joe, let me ask you, when you sit back and look at that region, there is an historic divide in Islam between the Sunnis and the Shias. You've got Iran, Syria, Hezbollah on one side. You've got Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and other Gulf states on the other. Is what we're seeing there a proxy holy war between the two sects of Islam?
Probably in a way, this kind of split that hits them every several centuries, right, since the eighth century and on. I don't know, I feel that the real lesson to be drawn from the recent events of the last 2 years in the Middle East, lesson number one is to be modest about prediction. I cannot predict. We've seen Egypt, Mubarak, he was mentioned earlier. He employed probably 500,000 people in secret services to make sure that what happened in the Tahrir Square will not happen. And it happened. So you cannot make a lot of, and he did not predict it. You cannot make long-term predictions. Second is to be, sometimes people say, if something really unspeakable happens, don't worry, the world will not be able to afford it, will step forward to do something about it. I beg to differ, look at Syria, it happens in front of our eyes, nothing happens. Lesson number three, which I want to mention here for Israel, it was argued by our best friends around the world for years that Israel, our inability to solve the problem with the Palestinians is the root cause of all the problems in the Middle East. Not to. Even if we solved our problems with them, probably we still have the Muslim Brothers take over Egypt, the Syrians cut or torn apart by this civil war, and probably even Iran try to reach nuclear capability. So I see there is a great divide. There is a great, not just within the Arab world, the Iranians are not Arabs at all. And the Arabs, what they see, that the Iranians are trying to create a Shiite radical axis that cuts into the Arab world through Damascus and southern Lebanon, the Assad regime and the Hezbollah, and to be against them. And then why you find the Saudis, the Emirates, and Jordan, so enthusiastic to put them at bay. So it can emerge into something terrible. You can see it within single nation in Iraq, more kind of explicitly. It can be there. I'm not sure what will happen. I dare not to make prediction. I can tell you about someone who made prediction, Mubarak. I remember a vivid conversation with him some 8 years ago when Bush Jr. initiated the free election, so to speak, in Iraq. And Mubarak joked with him, he said, what does America think? What is free election in the Arab world? We don't have free elections. Not every individual comes and votes according to his mind. We have a tribal, we are tribal societies. We have the patriarch of any family, wider family, clan, tribe, and they give orders how to vote. So the simplistic idea of giving Iraq free election means to give Iraq on a silver plate to the Iranians because the majority of the tribes are Shiite. And that's, you are very right on grand contours, on principles. But when it comes to the nuances of how to execute in the actual Middle East, there is a need for more kind of understanding of the kind of nuances.
So your question is a really important one. And it shows how things have changed in the Middle East. I think for a long time, everybody thought that the central, most explosive conflict was between Israelis and Palestinians. It's a serious conflict, and we ought to be devoting any amount of leadership we can to try to resolve it. But today, in my opinion, the most serious and explosive conflict in the Middle East is really between within Islam, between Sunnis and Shias, and it is exacerbated in the case of Iran with the rest of the Arab world, because the Iranians are not only Shia, but they're Persian, not Arabs. In some of the countries in the region, the autocratic leaders stifled the Sunni-Shia conflict. So Saddam was Sunni, and he beat up pretty bad on the Shias, but it didn't explode. The same was true of Assad in Syria, he being Alawite, but a kind of Shia. And in that case, he suppressed the Sunnis. Now this is all being let out, and it's a very dangerous situation. In my opinion, it's beyond, let me focus on Syria a minute. Obviously, I think we should be doing more because it's a form of genocide going on there. And maybe 100,000 people killed, millions displaced as refugees. But there's two other big dangers in Syria if we don't act to control it. One is that it will be the flashpoint that will ignite a larger regional Sunni-Shia conflict, that a catastrophe will occur in Syria, which will end up being no government, sectarian warfare that will engage Iraq and Iran as well. And of course, the other reason why what happens in Syria is important is because it's a kind of proxy war for the most significant threat in the Middle East, which is Iran becoming a nuclear power. And if Assad is able to stay in power in Syria, he being Iran's number one ally in the Arab world with Russia's support, it's a terrible setback for us. And I think so far our inaction there sends a message to Iran that we're not really serious. And I think it's part of the reason why they're not really dealing with us on nuclear weapons.
Let me ask all of you about the role of oil in that region. The United States, we've always acknowledged that our security, we had a vital security interest in what was happening in the Middle East, and a big part of that was our dependence on Middle Eastern oil. There's a good chance that within the next few years we could become energy independent, you know, based on what we're seeing on natural gas development, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, if we become energy independent, say by 2020, if not sooner, will that lessen our involvement in the Middle East? Will it change the way we view the Middle East? I ask that because I've heard that same question from those in the Middle East that I've met with who asked, you know, if you become oil independent, is that going to change the U.S.'s relationship to the Middle East? What do you think?
It's triggered our interest in the Middle East in the past. If you ask any administration, why are we doing whatever we were doing, there were modest situations. It was because oil. Even when Iraq invaded Kuwait, President Bush said, well, it's because of aggression. Secretary Baker said, it's oil. they both made a good point, I suppose. The dilemma here is that we had with Iraq getting, and this is a part of this question and the last one, situation in which the intelligence was not very good, and so the thought was that Saddam Hussein must go because he was developing nuclear weapons, or he had nuclear weapons, that there was a real threat. You couldn't stand by. So we sent a huge amount of armament in there to take care of Saddam, and we did. Then Americans said, now listen, we're going to have problems in the Middle East for a long time. So this is a good sort of a shining city on the hill example. We're going to turn this country into a democracy with human rights, with thoughts about women and children, and people are going to treat each other well. And it'll be such a remarkable example that all the rest of these countries around are going to want to have the Iraq situation. We believed in our own situation, and we should, that we're a democracy, we're a special country, and so forth. But we want to work, and 10 years later, the government, so-called freely elected, decided it's time for you folks to go, if not just that we wanted out that fast. And furthermore, as we read now, Syria, horrible in terms of the number of people getting killed every week, but sort of in lesser articles, about 300 people for the last 4 or 5 weeks killed in Iraq each week, with Sunnis fighting Shiites. And there is no America to control this at this point. The thought is, as a matter of fact, the Kurds are sort of gone. The oil agreement never occurred, and they're really busy with the Turks now and the Syrians up north. So Iraq's not going to be Iraq as we used to know it in the old days. And so here we've had freedom and all the rest of it, but the people that are there are still fighting the Sunni Shiite business liberated by the United States from Saddam, who suppressed all of this. Now, this is a different problem to assess. You know, I'm not arguing in favor of Saddam staying necessarily, but we've been very quick to say Ben Ali must go, Saddam, Mubarak must go, everybody must go, as if it was a... And here, a little better judgment may be required as we proceed, oil or not, because I think we could get enough oil out of Mexico presently and the Canadians and really take care of that problem. We could have Keystone Pipeline. That's another subject all by itself. But we can get that job done. What is not so easy to do is when you really have high ideals and you go into Iraq after nuclear weapons and then after reforming the country, and you come out with a situation such as we have there, $1 trillion spent of American taxpayer money, 4,500 lives lost. Well, this is pretty sobering as you take a look even presently at the situations there.
Yeah, Joe, let me just to kind of follow up on that. You know, there's clearly a certain exhaustion after these last 10 years. We fought a war in Iraq. We fought a war in Afghanistan. The president clearly kind of reflects that cautiousness about getting involved again in another Middle East war. And then if you combine that with the oil issue, I mean, where are we headed in terms of United States leadership in that part of the world?
Well, I worry about where we're headed. I mean, I'll just go back to answer your previous question. Inevitably, the more we have our own energy resources, which is a miraculous development, the fact that we may be taking so much oil and gas out of shale, the more that we develop our own energy resources, inevitably we're going to be less tied to the Middle East diplomatically. It's going to take leadership to keep us engaged. Now, let me just go to the question you just asked, because it's really important, because now we are war-weary, but the reality is that if we pull back from the conflict in Syria, from our relationship with the moderate Arab countries who are our allies there, I can't imagine us pulling back from our relationship to Israel, but if we did that, the consequences for us in terms of our prosperity, our security, and our national values are serious. But it's going to take more argument. I mean, look, I can tell you, we all know that the price of oil and gas are set on international markets. So even though we're producing, we'll still be affected by what happens there. We'll also be affected by the fact that we are going to be targets in an internal, a kind of civil war within Islam between the extremists and everybody else. And a lot of that is happening in the Middle East. So if we pull out of that, as we saw in 9/11, we can get hit again right here at home. And our ties to Israel in terms of our national values, our history, are deep. So, but it's not going to be as easy to make the case the more energy independent we become.
Ehud.
I believe that Joe is right about America turning into energy independent will inevitably have lesser interest in what happens in the Middle East, especially that it has interest in the Far East, and duly so. But when you look at the grand contours of the next decade, I believe it will be characterized by a not kind of antagonism, but a symbiotic relationship with China based on trade, currencies, and whatever else. But underneath this umbrella of symbiotic relationship with China, the Chinese will keep churning into the vital interests of American local allies. And those local allies will inevitably look at what happened in the previous decade, this decade, in the Middle East, in order to ask themselves, what is the worth of being backed by America? They will point to Mubarak, great ally for 30 years. There is a question whether he was left there after 3 weeks, 3 days, or 3 hours, I don't know. Which is the right answer, but it's not simple. And basically, America is in a contradicting terms. You support the right of the people to decide by themselves, but for reasons of stability, you back the dictator. So the moment that the public stand on their feet and try to rebel against the regime, you intuitively, that's your character, that's your destiny, probably duly so, you support the rebellion. So you should ask yourself to what extent these autocrats can rely on you, and it's a legitimate question for them. If America, you know, and probably the previous series, if the administration will turn around the economy, if the administration will reach certain agreement on immigration, if they put gun control under different terms, it's domestically, it could be great administration. But if on the world arena it ends up that after 10 years, as Dick mentioned, Iraq is far from being stable, Syria turning to be another chaotic place of no man's land, Afghanistan far from being stable, probably will fall into the hands of Taliban next year, Pakistan another nightmare, and Iran turned nuclear under these the watch of this administration that will send the worst possible signals to dictators all around the world and to other players about the what kind of courage of conviction for action could be found within these great people. It's by far the greatest people on earth, but it ends up on the public arena with the character and capability to make decisions however difficult they are.
Let's quickly turn to the peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. Secretary Kerry has obviously gotten pretty directly involved. He's talked to leaders in Israel. He's talked to the Palestinian leaders. He's trying to urge a return to the negotiating table to try to resolve this issue. It's been a while. Obviously, Clinton was pretty much directly involved. Both Presidents Bush and President Obama have been much more cautious about getting involved because of the difficulties of making it work. What do you think are the chances that the parties will in fact sit down and negotiate?
I hope they will, and it's extremely important for the region, for us, for our neighbors. I'm not sure that is a lot of place for optimism in this regard, because the world and even the region lost the intensity of interest in this issue. Mm. Because of the lesson that I mentioned briefly earlier, both the Saudi court, the Jordanians, the Emirates, the Gulf states, they see more urgent issue in the struggle for leadership with the Shiite, with the radical, what happens in Syria, what happens in Egypt. They are now, all the moderates in the Arab world are crushed between the fears of a nuclear Iran and the fears of a Muslim brotherhood taking more and more societies. So it's not easy to invest the political capital, the attention. And both players, unfortunately, both on other side, our side, but mainly on the Palestinian side, they're under pressure from their own public. And when there is no pressure to solve it, no sense of urgency, it won't be easy for Secretary Kerry. I know how much he's devoted for it and wants to do it, and he was involved even as a senator very intensively. It's not extremely good. I hope it will happen because it's critical for the future of the region. There is, if we would not be able on time, before it's too late, strike a deal toward two states for two nations, namely to delineate a line within which we'll have a solid majority, and on the other side, living side by side with the Palestinian independent state, we will head into a tragedy, because between the Jordan River and the sea, there live 12 million people, probably 8 million Israel, 4 million Palestinians, probably a little bit more Palestinians. If there is only one political entity named Israel reigning over this whole area, it will become inevitably, and that's the key word, inevitably, either non-Jewish or non-democratic, because if this block of millions of Palestinians with their national aspiration, you cannot hide it, will vote for the Knesset, it is a binational state par excellence. If they cannot vote to the Knesset, it's not a democracy. Neither was the Zionist dream. So we have a compelling imperative, not stemming out for something that we're not doing a favor to the Palestinians, out of our long-term national interest to solve it. That doesn't mean that the leadership on the region is aware of it. I believe that our leadership is more ready than anyone else around.
Yeah, and I'd just like to ask
quickly,
why doesn't Israel just simply define the state that it wants to live in? This is absolutely critical. It could take a while for the Palestinians ever to unite, and they may be tied up with Hezbollah someplace and somebody else somewhere else. But since this is so critical to have a Jewish state, why not simply define the boundaries and say, this is Israel? Now, you folks now may want to work out the rest of it yourselves.
In a hypothetical place, you know. You know, here in Monterrey, it sounds easier than it's on the ground.
Right?
We are living in
it always does.
Yeah, you know, it's really a tough neighborhood. We are the place where the prophecy of the, you know, supposedly the lion and the lamb should lie together, but somehow on practice you have to replace the lamb every several days. So we are not ready to be the lamb. We choose to be. It's about gridlock or choices. We choose to be a benign lion, and so it's tough, but it's not, you know, inconceivable. I propose as a prime minister, when we see that we can't strike a deal, even with the pressure of direct pressure, kind of intensive pressure of President Clinton, we could not strike a deal with Arafat. I propose to our people to turn to unilateral disengagement from the Palestinians, to delineate a line, as you said, and to make sure that within it we have a solid majority for generation. On the other side, let the Palestinians build their own. I couldn't convince the public of Israel. They voted for Sharon. And so it reminds me of Adlai Stevenson after his debate with Dewey. He asked for some report. So a great analytic firm in New York published for him 1,000 pages of a report. The executive summary at the first page said, "You lost the vote because you lost election because you didn't have enough votes." So you have in Israel, you have to convince the public. No. Israelis are, you will translate, they are ready to make great daring step, but not to be friars. How do you call it, friars? Suckers or whatever, I know how to call it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They are not
fools, yeah.
To do something on your own. When it seems that you made concessions, the other guy didn't give anything, it need different, it need a lot of conviction on behalf of all players to create in a democracy a coalition that will go for it.
Joe, quickly.
I had a quick word on this. I agree with what Ehud has said, of course, that a two-state solution, a peace agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians, is a noble goal, and it's hard to be optimistic about achieving it now. But I do want to say that I admire and appreciate John Kerry's devotion to this, and I assume obviously it reflects President Obama's devotion, not just because of the effort to try to do it, but because it does increase America's credibility in the region, and that will be critical in the months ahead as we deal with the most significant threat to the region and to America, which is Iran. The president will probably have to make a decision sometime in the foreseeable future about whether to use America's military might to disable Iran's nuclear program. And the efforts that we're making now to try to reconcile the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I think, help build our credibility on the Arab street.
I want to certainly touch on Iran and Syria before we get to the questions from the audience. But we're at the midway point, and what I do at this midway point is to recognize the question review team, the people that are responsible for selecting the various questions that will be presented to our speakers. So if I could ask you to just hold your applause while I introduce them. They are Catherine Ball, who is the digital editor from Salinas, California; Julie Copeland, who's the city editor from the Santa Cruz Sentinel; Fran Gaver, attorney with Leach & Walker; Doug McKnight, who's a reporter from KAZU Radio; and Philip Molnar, who is a business reporter for the Monterey County Herald. If you would thank them. We also have a great group of students with us this evening, and I would like all of them who are here to please stand and hold your applause. Let me recognize where they're from and what schools they represent. There are three schools that are represented here. Stand up, guys. Where the hell are you? There you are. You see them all in the back here. Please stand up. That's it. Great. We've got a lot of people in uniform because they come from the Defense Language Institute, a great language facility here, and the Naval Postgraduate School, another great facility here on the peninsula, and then Monterey High School, which is my old alma mater. So thank you all for coming here. And I also, you know, obviously the student participation can only happen when we have the generous support of our lecture series sponsors. And Sylvia and I and the whole Panetta Institute board are very grateful for the sponsorship that allows these students come from colleges, universities, high schools, military installations here throughout the Central Coast so that they can participate. Would you please give our sponsors a great hand, too? Thank you.